Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Melanie walked into her 13-year-old daughter's bedroom and switched on the lights. I thought you'd be getting ready for Dina's party, she said. Teal was curled up in her chair, looking out the window, hugging her favorite stuffed animal, a well-worn teddy bear.
I just can't go, she murmured. I can't.
What's wrong, honey? Melanie sat on the edge of the bed and looked at her daughter. The girl's eyes looked frightened and her skin was unusually pale.
Oh, I don't know,
Teela began to whimper.
I can't leave here, that's all. I just can't.
Is there something you're afraid of? Melanie gently prodded. You haven't really come out of your room much for a few days now.
No,
Teela began.
Yes. Oh, I don't know. It's just safer to be in here.
She hugged her bear tightly. All right, replied Melanie. You don't have to go, but I do think we need to talk about this later on, okay?
Oh, thank you, Mom.
Teela's face broke into a wan smile.
Maybe tomorrow I'll feel better.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about children and anxiety disorders? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is an expert on psychiatric disorders in children and adolescents. Dr. Daniel Pine is Chief of Child and Adolescent Research in the Mood and Anxiety Disorders Program of the National Institute of Mental Health Intramural Research Program. He has been engaged continuously in research focusing on the epidemiology, biology, and treatment of psychiatric disorders in children and adolescents. His areas of expertise include biological and pharmacological aspects of mood, anxiety, and behavioral disorders in children, as well as classification of psychopathology across the lifespan. Dr. Pine is also a father. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Thank you.
What's the difference between a child's undergoing stress or being anxious and having an actual disorder?
One of the major questions that we have as mental health professionals is exactly how to tell the difference between normal fluctuations in anxiety and fluctuations in anxiety that are part of a mental disorder that needed to be treated. One of the easiest things to think about is the degree to which anxiety interferes with functioning. So whenever we see a child who has anxiety that is so extreme that that child cannot do something, that that child has to avoid something, something that most other children can do, we have a strong suspicion that that child will be suffering from an anxiety disorder. The story that you began the program with is quite illustrative of that idea. In that child, we would be worried that this level of anxiety was extreme, was an indicator of an anxiety disorder because this child couldn't do something. The child couldn't leave their room and the child couldn't go to and attend an event that other children are able to do.
Are there different types of anxiety disorders?
One of the issues that both physicians and researchers are struggling with is exactly how we divide up kinds of anxiety. Without question, if we look at the kinds of things that children are afraid of, there's pretty good evidence that we can classify them or break them down. So some children are particularly afraid of social things. They'll get nervous at parties. They'll get nervous if they have to give a presentation in front of class. They'll get nervous when they have to meet new friends, people that they've never met before. And their worries and their anxieties will be restricted to that one specific set of event. Other children won't be nervous at all about social things, but they'll be nervous about a completely different class of events. So they'll worry about something bad happening to their parents. They won't want to sleep alone without their parents with them. They won't want to go outside of the house unless their parents come with them. Without question, when we look at the kinds of things that kids complain about, we can divide anxiety up into meaningful categories. One of the things that we don't know, however, is the degree to which the underlying neural correlates or the parts of the brain that are involved in those behaviors are similar or different in children who have different kinds of anxiety. Moreover, when we look at the kinds of treatments that work for anxiety, the similarities are actually greater than the differences. So if you think about those two different groups of children, the child who's afraid of social things but is fine with separation, versus the child who is very afraid of separation but is fine at social things, the types of treatments that we think about and the way that we implement them are actually quite similar for both of those children.
Are anxiety disorders related to other mental illnesses in any clear way, like obsessive-compulsive disorder?
There's a fair amount of debate about whether obsessive-compulsive disorder should be considered an anxiety disorder. Without question, people who have obsessive-compulsive disorder can be quite anxious. And in the United States, the way in which mental health professionals think about anxiety disorders involves including obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, as an anxiety disorder. In Europe, however, mental health professionals think about it a little differently. And there, obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, is actually not thought about as an anxiety disorder, but thought about as a unique disorder that's different from anxiety disorders and that's different from depression. One of the important things about anxiety is that it shows a much broader set of associations with really a whole range of other mental syndromes. So besides OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, the other really important one is depression or major depression. There is an incredibly strong relationship between major depression and anxiety disorders. And it looks like that is a developmental relationship. So what that means is that it is very common for adults with depression to have their problems start during childhood and to start as an anxiety disorder.
Any genetics involved?
With most mental disorders, we think of them as a complex mix of both environmental factors and genetic factors. And it's true of anxiety disorders, as it's really true of pretty much every mental disorder. The way in which mental disorders differ is different kinds of mental disorders have different mixes of environmental components and genetic components. So some syndromes like autism or syndromes like bipolar disorder, have an overwhelmingly strong genetic component. Other syndromes like schizophrenia, have about an equal mix of genetic and environmental components. And still other syndromes like anxiety disorders, have a reasonably strong genetic component, but an even stronger environmental component. So for the anxiety disorders, while there's both an environmental and a genetic component, the contribution of environmental factors, things related to stress that a child might experience, is probably somewhat stronger than the contribution from genetics.
How do these kinds of disorders manifest themselves in children?
One of the most interesting things that we see in the anxiety disorders is that kids will become afraid of different things at different times in their lives. And we see this both with normal anxiety, and then we also see it with anxiety disorders. Somewhat early in children's development, around the early school age years, many children will have normal fears about separation. Children with anxiety disorders will have fears about separation that go beyond what a normal child will experience.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. We call this separation anxiety disorder. And a child with separation anxiety disorder will refuse to go to school, will refuse to go to parties, will refuse to go to social events unless their parent comes with them.
How do we differentiate between that and what we see a lot of preschoolers and kindergartners and even first graders going through at the beginning of
the year? Sure. The key difference is both in terms of degree of anxiety. So while normal school children will experience some anxiety when they leave their parents, they can usually tolerate that anxiety to the point where they can go. The child with anxiety disorder will have the anxiety that is so extreme that they can't tolerate it. So number one, it's more severe. But then number two, the duration and the adaptability of the child differs in a child who has normal anxiety versus abnormal anxiety. A child with normal anxiety will have a transient increase in their anxiety. Maybe they'll feel nervous right when they walk in the door, or maybe they'll feel nervous the first week of school. But after they've been at school for an hour or two, or after they've been at school for a few weeks, that anxiety will dissipate and it won't be there anymore.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on anxiety disorders in children.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Daniel Pine about anxiety disorders in children.
At what ages or developmental stages are symptoms of an actual anxiety disorder most likely to surface?
There's a fair amount of debate about that, and that in the history of thinking about anxiety disorders, there's been a progressive change in how people think about them. So maybe 10 or 20 years ago, people really focused predominantly on the adolescent or adult years as a time when anxiety disorders were a major problem. Maybe in the last 5 or 10 years, there was a shift from thinking about anxiety in adolescence or adulthood and thinking more about the full range of childhood. So really, I think right now, people are concerned about impairing anxiety disorders really throughout childhood. So from the school age years all the way through adolescence. And I think it's reasonably well accepted that it is not uncommon to see a child with an anxiety disorder from the school age years forward. Probably one of the biggest current controversies has to do with whether we can identify the signs of anxiety even earlier. And there continues to be a lot of debate among people who think that we can identify the initial signs of anxiety even in preschoolers, whereas other people think that it's really not an appropriate thing to think about such a diagnosis in a preschooler, that we tend to think about it more in school-age children.
Is research noticing certain kinds of personality profiles that look like, that one's probably going to have some anxiety issues?
There's a few things to say about the relationship between anxiety early in life and anxiety later in life. There clearly is an association. So even young children who have signs of anxiety that is very extreme have some degree of an increased risk for being anxious and being depressed 10, 20 years later. So there clearly is an association, number one. Number two, the strength of that association is no more than moderate. So having anxiety as a child, while it should somewhat increase the concern of the parent, is by no means destiny. That far more than half of young children who have extreme anxiety will have no sign of anxiety if you follow them up into adulthood. Number three, in adults who have problems with mood and anxiety, it is actually quite rare for those problems to come on all of a sudden out of nowhere after adolescence. You should be watching your child and observing your child to do everything you can to facilitate the dissipation of that child's anxiety. And that is the normal developmental change that happens to anxious children as they grow up. But it's very important to attend to it and pay attention to it, because in that early anxiety that we see in the child, we can see the roots of risk for many adult problems.
What kinds of parental behaviors are good to try to alleviate some of this anxiety?
This is the kind of thing that researchers are only beginning to think about right now. But one of the most important lessons that I think parents can take away is that parents really need to attend to issues of avoidance. One of the reasons that it's important is that it is the first clue that this problem might be significant in terms of being a sign of not normal anxiety, but an anxiety disorder. The second reason that avoidance is important is that one of the ways that children overcome their anxiety is by working with a parent or working with a clinician to learn how to face up to their fears. So that when you can teach a child that they can overcome their fears and that they can get over a thing that they're afraid of by not avoiding it, but by facing it, it's a difficult struggle for parents, because the only way that anxious children can get over their avoidance is to tolerate some degree of anxiety. And so it's very hard for parents, and I can say it as a father, that when my own children are anxious about something, it's very hard to push them to the point where their anxiety will dissipate. But the important lesson for parents to take away is that some degree of anxiety is normal, and for children who have somewhat higher levels of anxiety, it is actually healthy to help your children to experience and tolerate that anxiety, and that it is probably not good to do everything you can to make sure that your child never experiences any anxiety.
If we suspect our child might have an anxiety disorder, What should we be doing as parents?
More and more, pediatricians are becoming one of the first places that parents can turn when they're struggling with the degree to which a problem is a normal variation in behavior or an anxiety disorder. So in any instance where a parent is concerned about any mental health issue, including anxiety, talking with your pediatrician about the degree to which that behavior or that problem is normal and expectable is a wonderful first place to go. After that, there are a number of wonderful resources that are available to parents. One of the best books available to parents is Parenting Your Anxious Child by Ronald Rapee. That's R-A-P-E-E. And that's a book that I frequently tell parents to read that's written by one of the world's experts on pediatric anxiety that's both accurate but also written in a language that parents find very helpful. There are a number of websites that have really wonderful information for parents. Two that are particularly good are the website of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. So that is the website of the AACAP. And the website of the Anxiety Disorders Association of America, or the ADAA. And then last of all, the NIH, National Institute of Health, is a wonderful resource for parents who have any questions, both about their specific child, but about anxiety in general. And the way to contact us at the National Institute of Health is at 1-866-627-6464. That's 1-866-627-6464.
Now, what about things that we both can control and can't control as parents in terms of the environment? You sort of touched on the environment. First of all, of course, the home environment. How we act as parents would seem to me to feed into if a kid is more anxious or less anxious. And then, of course, there's the business of the siblings, and then we have the wider pond of the peers at school. How can we deal with all these different variables?
The first thing to remember is that some degree of anxiety is not only normal, but it's probably healthy. That anxiety is a behavior and a phenomena that we really see huge similarities in across a range of mammalian species. And we would not do that unless there was something adaptive or helpful or protective about anxiety. So the first thing to know as parents is that some degree of anxiety is expectable and should even be reassuring. And we shouldn't get too upset every single time we see anxiety in our child, number one. Number two, anxiety, like other mental health problems in children, is what we call multifactorial. So what that means is anxiety does not have one cause. Anxiety has many causes. And many of the parents that I see who come with questions about why their child is anxious really rack their brains to think about what they might have done to make their child as anxious as they are. And what I say to them is that it is highly unlikely that any one thing could contribute to making a child very anxious. And any parent who has two children has to be struck by the fact that we can treat those children as similarly as possible, and they will grow up and turn out to be radically different. So how parents treat their children is only one factor that contributes to anxiety. And parents can do absolutely everything right, and their child might still turn out to be anxious, or they can do absolutely everything wrong, and their child might be fine. So it really does not help parents to think about what they might have done wrong and how they might have contributed to the anxiety in their child, because that's only one of many factors. And then the third thing that's important for parents to understand is this idea about avoidance. That as parents who really care about our children, I think one of our first reactions is to do anything we can to take away any anxiety that our children have. And that's probably a mistake. That one of the ways that we can help our children best is that when they have anxiety, to work with them, to help them master it and overcome it, partly by tolerating it, and partly by being in the situations that make them anxious.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on anxiety disorders in children.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Pine about anxiety disorders in children.
I have two examples I want to just mention. One of them is a little girl who's now a teenager, was terrified of going to birthday parties if there was a clown. And it started the first time she went to a birthday party and a clown arrived and she began screaming her head off. She wanted to get out of there. She was young enough at the time that a parent was there with her. And the parent just sat with her. They stayed at the party. Of course, she's not afraid of clowns anymore, but while she was still little, they did a lot of book reading. There are a lot of clowns in children's books. And so apparently they did just what you're saying. The other is a more recent story. A few weeks ago, we had the opportunity to take my 3-year-old granddaughter to the zoo. And the whole way there in the car, she was talking about how she loves the giraffes. Those are her favorite animals, but she was not going to see the lions and the tigers. Those are very scary. And so we're riding in the car and we're saying, yes, yes, why are they scary? Oh, they make a very loud roar. We get to the zoo. She runs across the field towards the giraffes, very excited. She's going to see giraffes and zebras. And after we saw those, she said, and now we'll go see the lions. I was getting very anxious because I didn't want her to get upset. And her father very calmly took her by the hand and off we went to see the lions, who didn't roar. They were very quiet that day. And then we went to see the tigers. So it was all just going ahead and doing these things. So it's very interesting that you bring that up.
There's two principles of both of those stories that I think are wonderful and very important for parents to learn. The first principle, particularly in the story about the clown, that's really exactly what I mean by the importance of encouraging children to tolerate their fears. That is exactly the appropriate way to handle that type of fear. And that's a very common event. And so the key idea about that interaction between that parent and that child is that that parent sat with the child and that parent helped the child not to avoid the clown and not to get away from the clown and not to never feel anxious about clowns at all, but to confront the clown and to see that you could be around clowns and you could tolerate it and it wouldn't be harmful. So again, the key idea there is that it's more helpful to work with children so that they can tolerate the things that they're afraid of as opposed to avoid the things that they're afraid of. The second idea is that one of the ways that people, human beings, can manage their anxiety most effectively is to understand it and to learn how to predict it. One of the things that parents can do is to help children understand what are the situations where you really should feel danger and how can we predict them. And what are the situations where we really don't need to feel danger and how we can feel safe? And by talking to our children and explaining things to them while they're experiencing these situations, children learn how to tolerate those situations.
Dr. Pine, what about medications for anxious children?
Medications for children in general is one of the most controversial issues really in all of healthcare currently. And it's an incredibly complex area for many reasons. Probably the most important things to talk about, however, are the data that we have, number one, and then number two, to put the current controversy in a particular scientific context. The data that we have are that certain groups of medications are actually highly effective for children with anxiety disorders. Now, we don't know nearly enough about the degree to which medications and psychotherapies for the anxiety disorders work together. And we need far more research about which children really benefit most from medications and which from psychotherapy. However, it is really without question that a sizable group of children with anxiety will benefit tremendously from medication. And there are clearly children for whom psychotherapy is not an option, where medication is a reasonable alternative. As I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, there is a fair amount of controversy about medication use in children. And some of this controversy, I think, deals with issues that are outside of science, and I'm not going to speak to those issues, but other aspects of the controversy really do speak to issues related to the science about what we know about medications in children and what we know about anxiety in children. So I mentioned that most children with anxiety disorders will do well over time. And so because of that, I think that there's a fair amount of caution about, do we want to give medication to a child who has an anxiety disorder that's going to probably go away with time? And I think that that's a legitimate question. And I think it should probably give parents and physicians a reason to pause a little bit more when you're considering medication for an anxiety disorder relative to other kinds of mental problems, number one. Number two, the other thing we know about the medications that are highly effective for anxiety disorders is that some of the side effects that we see in these medications are more problematic for young people than they are for mature adults. So associations with impulsivity and the things that go with it, such as thoughts about suicide, we know are more tightly related to the use of medications effective in anxiety disorders among children and adolescents than they are in mature adults. So for all of those reasons, I think that there has been a fair amount of skepticism within the broader field of medicine, but also within the more narrow areas of people focusing on the treatment of anxiety disorders. That being said, without question, there are plenty of children for whom medications remain the only option for the treatment of anxiety disorders. So I think as long as a parent has seen a competent mental health professional, as long as the parent, child, and the mental health professional are really convinced that the anxiety has both been longstanding and is significantly impacting on the well-being of the child, and as long as other options have been exhausted, then I think it is perfectly reasonable to provide a medication for a child with an anxiety disorder.
Well, Dr. Daniel Pine, this has been a very anxiety-reducing conversation, and we thank you so much for being with us to help us discuss anxiety disorders in children.
Thank you for the time.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 340 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our special appreciation to the American Psychiatric Foundation for its generosity in bringing you this program. We especially need your feedback on this show. Just go to our website. Again, that's www.parentsperspective.org, and click onto the very brief survey to let us know your responses. Thank you for tuning in. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.